This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Political essayist and author Arundhati Roy, the winner of the Booker Prize for her novel, The God of Small Things, speaking at the Riverside Church in New York City on May 13th.
Democracy, the modern world's holy cow, is in crisis. And the crisis is a profound one. Every kind of outrage is being committed in the name of democracy. It has become little more than a hollow word, a pretty shell emptied of all content or meaning. It can be whatever you want it to be. Democracy is the free world's whore, willing to dress up, dress down, willing to satisfy a whole range of taste, available to be used and abused at will. Until quite recently, right up to the 1980s, democracy did seem as though it might actually succeed in delivering a degree of real social justice. But modern democracies have been around for long enough for neoliberal capitalists to learn how to subvert them. They have mastered the technique of infiltrating the instruments of democracy, the independent judiciary, the free press, the parliament, and molding them to their purpose. The project of corporate globalization has cracked the code. Free elections, a free press, and an independent judiciary mean little when the free market has reduced them to commodities available on sale to the highest bidder. To fully comprehend the extent to which democracy is under siege, it might be an idea to look at what goes on in some of our contemporary democracies. The world's largest, India, which I have written about at some length and therefore will not speak about tonight. The world's most interesting, South Africa. The world's most powerful, the USA. And most instructive of all, the plans that are being made to usher in the world's newest, Iraq. In South Africa, after 300 years of brutal domination of the black majority by a white minority through colonialism and apartheid, a non-racial, multi-party democracy came to power in 1994. It was a phenomenal achievement. Within 2 years of coming to power, the African National Congress had genuflected with no caveats to the market god. Its massive program of structural adjustment, privatization, and liberalization has only increased the hideous disparities between the rich and the poor. More than 1 million people have lost their jobs. The corporatization of basic services, electricity, water, and housing, has meant that 10 million South Africans, almost a quarter of the population, has been disconnected from water and electricity. 2 million have been evicted from their homes. Meanwhile, a small white minority that has been historically privileged by centuries of brutal exploitation are more secure than ever before. They continue to control the land, the farms, the factories, and the abundant natural resources of that country. For them, the transition from apartheid to neoliberalism barely disturbed the grass. It's apartheid with a clean conscience, and it goes by the name of democracy. Democracy. Democracy has become empire's euphemism for neoliberal capitalism. In countries of the First World, too, the machinery of democracy has been effectively subverted. Politicians, media barons, judges, powerful corporate lobbies, and government officials are imbricated in an elaborate underhand configuration that completely undermines the lateral arrangement of checks and balances between the Constitution, courts of law, parliament, the administration, and perhaps most important of all, the independent media that form the structural basis of a parliamentary democracy. Increasingly, the imbrication is neither subtle nor elaborate. Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, for instance, has a controlling interest in major Italian newspapers, magazines, television channels, and publishing houses. The Financial Times reported that he controls about 90% of Italy's television viewership. Recently, during a trial on bribery charges, while insisting he was the only person who could save Italy from the left, he said, How much longer do I have to keep living this life of sacrifices? That bodes ill for the remaining 10% of Italy's TV viewership. What price free speech? Free speech for whom? In the United States, the arrangement is more complex. Clear Channel Worldwide Incorporated is the largest radio station owner in the country. It runs more than 1,200 channels, which together account for 9% of the market. Its CEO contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to Bush's election campaign. When hundreds of thousands of American citizens took to the streets to protest against the war on Iraq, Clear Channel organized pro-war patriotic rallies for America across the country. It used its radio stations to advertise the events and then sent correspondents to cover them as though they were breaking news. The era of manufacturing consent has given way to the era of manufacturing news. Soon, media newsrooms will drop the pretense and start hiring theater directors instead of journalists. As America's show business gets more and more violent and warlike, and America's wars get more and more like show business, some interesting crossovers are taking place. The designer who built the $250,000 set in Qatar, from which General Tommy Franks stage-managed news coverage of Operations Shock and Awe, also built sets for Disney, MGM, and Good Morning America. It's a cruel irony that the U.S., which has the most ardent, vociferous defenders of the idea of free speech, and until recently the most elaborate legislation to protect it, has so circumscribed the space in which that freedom can be expressed. In a strange way, the sound and fury that accompanies the legal and conceptual defense of free speech in America serves to mask the process of the rapid erosion of the possibilities of actually exercising that freedom. The news and entertainment industry in the U.S. is for the most part controlled by a few major corporations: AOL, Time Warner, Disney, Viacom, News Corporation. Each of these corporations owns and controls TV stations, film studios, record companies, and publishing ventures. Effectively, the exits are sealed. America's media empire is controlled by a tiny coterie of people. Chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Michael Powell, the son, by coincidence, of course, of the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, has proposed even further deregulation of the telecommunications industry, which will lead to even greater consolidation. So here it is, the world's greatest democracy, led by a man who was not legally elected. America's Supreme Court gifted him his job. What price have American people paid for this spurious presidency? In the 3 years of George Bush the Lesser's term, the American economy has lost more than 2 million jobs. Outlandish military expenses, corporate welfare, and tax giveaways to the rich have created a financial crisis for the U.S. educational system. According to a survey by the National Council of State Legislatures, U.S. states cut $49 billion in public services, health, welfare benefits, and education in 2002. They plan to cut another $25.7 billion this year. That makes a total of $75 billion. Bush's initial budget request to the Congress to finance the war in Iraq was $80 billion. So who's paying for the war? America's poor, its students, its unemployed, its single mothers, its hospital and home care patients, its teachers and health workers. And who's actually fighting the war? Once again, America's poor. The soldiers who are baking in Iraq's desert sun are not the children of the rich. Only one of all the representatives in Congress and the Senate has a child fighting in Iraq. America's volunteer army, in fact, depends on a poverty draft of poor whites, blacks, Latinos, and Asians who are looking for a way to earn a living and get an education. Federal statistics show that African Americans make up 21% of the total armed forces and 29% of the U.S. Army, and they count for only 12% of the general population. It's ironic, isn't it, the disproportionately high representation of African Americans in the army and prison? Perhaps we should take a positive view and look at this as affirmative action at its most effective. Nearly 4 million Americans, 2% of the population, have lost the right to vote because of felony convictions. Of that number, 1.4 million are African Americans, which means that 13% of all voting age black people have been disenfranchised. For African Americans, there's also affirmative action in death. A study by the economist Amartya Sen shows that African Americans as a group have a lower life expectancy than people born in China, in the Indian state of Kerala, where I come from, Sri Lanka or Costa Rica. Bangladeshi men have a better chance of making it to the age of 40 than African American men from here in Harlem. This year, on what would have been Martin Luther King's 74th birthday, President Bush announced the University of Michigan's affirmative action program favoring blacks and Latinos. He denounced it. He called it divisive, unfair, and unconstitutional. The successful effort to keep blacks off the voting lists in the state of Florida in order that George Bush be elected was, of course, neither unfair nor unconstitutional. I don't suppose affirmative action for white boys from Yale ever is. So now we know who's paying for the war, we know who's fighting it, but who will benefit from it? Who is homing in on the reconstruction contracts estimated to be worth up to $100 billion? Could it be America's poor and unemployed and sick? Could it be America's single mothers or America's black and Latino minorities? Operation Iraqi Freedom, George Bush assures us, is about returning Iraqi oil to the Iraqi people. That is, returning Iraqi oil to the Iraqi people via corporate multinationals like Bechtel, like Chevron, like Halliburton. Once again, it's a small, tight circle that connects corporate, military, and government leadership to one another. The promiscuousness, the cross-pollination, is outrageous. Consider this. The Defense Policy Board is a government-appointed group that advises the Pentagon on defense policy. Its members are appointed by the Undersecretary of Defense and approved by Donald Rumsfeld. Its meetings are classified. No information is available for public scrutiny. The Washington-based Center for Public Integrity found that 9 out of the 30 members of the Defense Policy Board are connected to companies that were awarded defense contracts worth $76 billion between the years 2001 and 2002. One of them, Jack Sheehan, a retired Marine Corps general, is a senior vice president at Bechtel, the giant international engineering outfit. Riley Bechtel, the company chairman, is on the President's Export Council. Former Secretary of State George Shultz, who's also on the board of directors of the Bechtel Group, is the chairman of the advisory board on the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq. When asked by the New York Times whether he was concerned about the appearance of a conflict of interest, he said, "I don't know that Bechtel would particularly benefit from it, but if there's work to be done, Bechtel is the type of company that could do it." Bechtel has been awarded a $680 million reconstruction contract in Iraq. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, Bechtel contributed $1.3 million towards the 1999-2000 Republican campaign. Arcing across this subterfuge, dwarfing it by the sheer magnitude of its malevolence, is America's anti-terrorism legislation. The USA Patriot Act, passed on October 13, 2001, has become the blueprint for similar anti-terrorism bills in countries across the world. It was passed in the House of Representatives by a majority vote of 337-79. According to the New York Times, many lawmakers said that it had been impossible to truly debate or even read the legislation. The Patriot Act ushers in an era of systemic, automated surveillance. It gives the government the authority to monitor phones and computers and spy on people in ways that would have seemed completely unacceptable a few years ago. It gives the FBI the power to seize all the circulation, purchasing, and other records of library users and bookstore customers on the suspicion that they are part of a terrorist network. It blurs the boundaries between speech and criminal activity, creating the space to construe acts of civil disobedience as violating the law. Already, hundreds of people are being held indefinitely as unlawful combatants. In India, the number is in the thousands. In Israel, 5,000 Palestinians have been detained. Non-citizens, of course, have no rights at all. They can be simply disappeared, like the people of Chile under Washington's old ally, General Pinochet. More than 1,000 people, many of them of Muslim or of Middle Eastern origin, have been detained, some without access to legal representatives. So apart from paying the actual economic costs of war, American people are paying for these spurious wars of liberation with their own freedoms. For the ordinary American, the price of new democracy in other countries is the death of real democracy at home. Meanwhile, Iraq is being groomed for liberation. Or did they mean liberalization all along? The Wall Street Journal reports that the Bush administration has drafted sweeping plans to make Iraq's economy, to remake Iraq's economy in the US image. Iraq's constitution is being redrafted, its trade laws, tax laws, and intellectual property laws being rewritten in order to turn it into an American-style capitalist economy. The United States Agency for International Development has invited US companies to bid for contracts that range between road building, water systems, textbook distribution, and cell phone networks. Soon after, Bush the Lesser announced that he wanted American farmers to feed the world, Dan Amstutz, a former senior executive of Cargill, the biggest grain producer exporter in the world, was put in charge of agricultural reconstruction in Iraq. Kevin Watkin, Oxfam's policy director, said, "Putting Dan Amstutz in charge of agriculture reconstruction in Iraq is like putting Saddam Hussein in the chair of a human rights commission." Two men who have been shortlisted to run operations for managing Iraq's oil have worked with Shell, BP, and Fleur. Fleur is embroiled in a lawsuit by black South African workers who have accused the company of exploiting and brutalizing them during the apartheid era. Shell, of course, is well known for its devastation of the Ogoni tribal lands in Nigeria. Tom Brokaw, one of America's best-known anchors, TV anchors, was inadvertently succinct about the process. "One of the things we don't want to do," he said, "is to destroy the infrastructure of Iraq, because in a few days we are going to own that country." Now that the ownership deeds are being settled, Iraq is ready for new democracy. So, as Lenin used to ask, what is to be done? Well, we might as well accept the fact that there is no conventional military force that can successfully challenge the American war machine. Terrorist strikes only give the US government an opportunity that it is eagerly awaiting to further tighten its stranglehold. Within days of an attack, you can bet that Patriot 2 would be passed. To argue against U.S. military aggression by saying that it will increase the possibilities of terrorist strikes is futile. It's like threatening Brer Rabbit that you'll throw him into the bramble bush. Anyone who's read the document called the Project for the New American Century can attest to that. The government's suppression of the Congressional Committee report on September 11th, which found that there was an intelligence warning of the strikes that was ignored, also attests to the fact that for all their posturing, the terrorists and the Bush regime might as well be working as a team. They both hold people. They both hold people responsible for the actions of their governments. They both believe in the doctrine of collective guilt and collective punishment. Their actions benefit each other greatly. The U.S. government has already displayed in no uncertain terms the range and extent of its capability for paranoid aggression. In human psychology, paranoid aggression is usually an indicator of nervous insecurity. It could be argued that it's no different in the case of the psychology of nations. Empire is paranoid because it has a soft underbelly. Its homeland may be defended by border patrols and nuclear weapons, but its economy is strung out across the globe. Its economic outposts are exposed and vulnerable. Already, the internet is buzzing with elaborate lists of American and British government products and companies that should be boycotted. Apart from the usual targets, Coke, Pepsi, McDonald's, government agencies like USAID, the British DFID, British and American banks, Arthur Andersen, Merrill Lynch, and American Express could find themselves under siege. These lists are being honed and refined by activists across the world. They could become a practical guide that directs the amorphous but growing fury in the world. Suddenly, the inevitability of the project of corporate globalization is beginning to seem more than a little inevitable. It would be naive to imagine that we can directly confront empire. Our strategy must be to isolate empire's working parts and disable them one by one. No target is too small, no victory too insignificant. We could reverse the idea of the economic sanctions imposed on poor countries by empire and its allies. We could impose a regime of people sanctions on every corporate house that has been awarded with a contract in post-war Iraq. Just as activists in this country and around the world targeted and exposed institutions of apartheid. Each one of them should be named, exposed, and boycotted, forced out of business. That could be our response to the shock and awe campaign. It would be a great beginning. Another urgent challenge is to expose the corporate media for the boardroom bulletin that it really is. We need to create a universe of alternative information. We need to support independent media like Democracy Now!, Alternative Radio, South End Press. The battle to reclaim democracy is going to be a difficult one. Our freedoms were not granted to us by any governments. They were wrested from them by us. And once we surrender them, the battle to retrieve them is called a revolution. It's a battle that must range across continents and countries. It must not acknowledge national boundaries. But if it is to succeed, it has to begin here in America. The only institution more powerful than the US government is American civil society. The rest of us are subjects of slave nations. We are by no means powerless, but you have the power of proximity. You have access to the imperial palace and the emperor's chambers. Empires' conquests are being carried out in your name, and you have the right to refuse. You could refuse to fight, refuse to move those missiles from the warehouse to the dock. Refuse to wave that flag. Refuse the victory parade.
Political essayist and author Arundhati Roy, the winner of the Booker Prize for her novel The God of Small Things, speaking at the Riverside Church in New York City on May 13, 2003. Her latest book, War Talk, an attack on U.S. foreign policy. Special thanks to Errol Maitland of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York for production assistance with that speech. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer tonight was T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammond of KPFA and Benta Berklin. Thanks to Pete Karak at RadioForAll.net and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.